Welcome to the Special Sauce Podcast, real conversations about food and life, hosted by Serious Eats founder, Ed Levine.
At the beginning of the pandemic, we were all clapping outside of our windows at 7 o'clock for those essential workers, everyone from the healthcare professionals in hospitals who were taking care of us, all the way to those very same delivery workers who were keeping us fed, many of whom actually perished because of the work that they were doing on the front lines.
On this episode of Special Sauce, we renew our conversation with New York State Senator and food and labor activist Jessica Ramos to find out what kind of good trouble she's making now. Plus, Kenji weighs in on making his Colombian wife her favorite Colombian soup. It's all coming up on Special Sauce. Last year, we talked to New York State Senator Jessica Ramos about the legislation she spearheaded to extend labor protections to farm workers. She succeeded by getting one bill passed that gives farm workers the right to collectively bargain, receive overtime, and even take a day off. Then Jessica spearheaded and got passed another bill to provide unemployment benefits to undocumented immigrants and other people who are not eligible for unemployment benefits over the course of the pandemic. Is that correct, Jessica?
Yes.
It was a temporary bill. And Jessica gets bonus points for representing one of the greatest eating neighborhoods in the world. District 13 contains Astoria, East Elmhurst, Corona, and Jackson Heights, all of whom I've spent many days exploring, Jessica, many, many days. So I had read about some more good trouble that you've gotten yourself into, you know, so I wanted to circle back with you, the indomitable Ms. Jessica Ramos. Welcome back, Jessica.
Well, it's good to be back, Ed. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I mean, the work that we need to do in the legislature for working people, especially coming out of the pandemic, is far from over. You know, it certainly is about worker protections and helping more people have more money in their pocket, more spending power in order to keep our local economies afloat. And that's why a lot of the work that I've been doing over the past few months has actually been around universal childcare and making sure that parents are able to return to work, but also that the childcare providers are paid a living wage as well. And this, of course, is all with the mission of keeping our children safe and giving them the best possible upbringing, making sure that we are arming them with socio-emotional intelligence to be the best workers of the future.
So where does that legislation line up right now?
We've actually been able to get a lot of the components of our bill into the One House State Senate bill, which is our response to the executive proposal by the governor. And now leadership from both houses, from the Senate and the Assembly, are going to enter negotiations with the governor, and we should have a final enacted budget by April 1st, which is when it expires every year here in New York.
Wow. It sounds like that this thing is actually going to happen.
Yes, it looks like we're going to see a major expansion of childcare, you know, especially in the areas where we need it most. You know, we are proposing to do away with the work requirement. We want to make it accessible to undocumented New Yorkers, so we're keeping all children safe. And we're doubling eligibility for those subsidies. Now, according to our plan in the Senate, and hopefully it holds through the final budget, families earning up to $138,000 would be able to see subsidized childcare. And that's with a 10% cap on these subsidies for all of New York's families. And right now, people are paying upwards of $20,000 a year, which is another rent in New York, where the cost of living is so damn high, right?
Yeah, that's crazy. So it's going to happen. And has the governor signaled that she is amenable to this?
Well, we know that she's interested in expanding childcare. She made her own proposal in the executive proposal that she put out early in January. We're pushing her to a bolder vision of more investment, of greater eligibility and accessibility. So we're hoping that she agrees with us on this and that the final budget will have these provisions.
Then the other thing that you're also involved with is trying to peg the minimum wage to inflation, right?
It's true. Look, right now, We all know that the cost of food is skyrocketing every day. The price of goods are artificially inflated by the biggest companies that control most of what we eat, wear, do, yet wages continue to be stagnant. And right now, many employers are arguing that there's a worker shortage when we know the truth. It's that workers are tired of being exploited and being paid peanuts to do really tough work. So what I want to do, and I actually had this idea before the pandemic, is to avoid shortfalls in people's livelihoods for their families by pegging the minimum wage to inflation, meaning that if the price of goods is to rise a few cents every day, well, then so should the minimum wage in order to keep up with the cost of living, especially in such an expensive place like New York.
Here's the thing. You take this stuff seriously. You took the new mayor of New York to task for something he said. You know, Jessica, you don't mess around.
I try not to. No, I take my job very seriously.
So what happened with him?
We've been talking about the vegan lunches in schools a lot. You know, I'm a mom to two boys. They're in the third and fifth grade. And obviously, making sure that they are fully nourished is something that I'm very concerned about. Ever since the school lunches changed, they've actually been arriving home a little hungry. And I then start to think about the children who depend on these school meals as their only meals throughout the day, because we do have poverty here in New York like that. Actually, one in five New Yorkers goes to bed hungry every single day. That's a whole lot of people in a city of 9 million, right? And so I ask the administration and the mayor to really make a concerted effort in figuring out what the nutritional goals for our children should be. And, you know, even if we do keep vegan lunches, which even though I'm not a vegan, I'm four and I'm fine with my children eating vegan lunches, but making sure that they receive the proper amount of protein. Protein is necessary to develop your muscles and, more importantly, to develop your brain. So this is what keeps children engaged in the classroom, keeps them learning, keeps them receptive. And so I think placing a greater emphasis on that and where we're sourcing our food from, you know, I always love to go back to those farms. Where we source that food from is really important. You know, the city of Buffalo, their school lunches are actually more than 30% sourced in New York State. And that makes sense. New York City should be no different. We produce more than enough vegetables and fruits and meat and dairy in order for us to offer these things to our children, who should have the option of eating whatever they want every day. In my opinion, what we need is for our children to eat and to eat healthy food and also create healthy eating habits that will hopefully carry them through adulthood and improve our health outcomes as a people.
Yeah, you have a very full plate, no pun intended. I think you took the new mayor to task for saying that all low-income workers were low-skill workers, and you took major exception to that.
I do.
Why don't you talk to us about that?
Well, there's no such thing as low-skill work. All labor has dignity. All labor takes work. All labor is valued by our society. Even workers who are making low wages are more than often than not contributing to the productivity of major corporations. And I'm thinking of the delivery workers, for example. And look, I'm a college dropout, and yet I have been able to lead my community and lead the labor committee into making significant changes and improvements to the labor law here in New York State. And so there's no one to say who is low skill and who is high skill. Our job is to make sure that jobs are good jobs that pay living wages and ensure that people can save for a rainy day. That's the goal. And there's no reason to put down anybody, the work that they are doing. I mean, everybody starts somewhere. And again, you know, all labor has dignity. And that is the sentiment that should be at the center of any labor conversation whatsoever.
Yeah, so it seems to me, what you're saying is it's all about human dignity, that being a low-skilled worker and being designated as so is just a rationale to pay you less.
That's right. That is what has created a hierarchy in valuing what worker must be paid more than the other. And look, at the beginning of the pandemic, we were all clapping outside of our windows at 7 o'clock for those essential workers. They were everyone from the healthcare professionals in hospitals who were taking care of us, all the way to those very same delivery workers who were keeping us fed, many of whom actually perished because of the work that they were doing on the front lines. We are yet to recognize hazard pay for these workers. We are yet to rectify violations of their workers' rights. And so what good is the denomination essential? How is it that we convey essential in a matter of compensation? Again, irregardless of, you know, what the person's skill might be, it's about the contribution and how needed this is. I mean, and sorry to go on a rant here, but this actually segues into the, you know, feminization of poverty, right? So many of the jobs that mostly women and especially women of color do, home care workers, child care providers, all of these women, this domestic labor has always kind of been seen as less than. And yet we trust them to clean our houses, to raise our children, to help take care of our elder parents. It boggles the mind.
Not only that, but a lot of them have jobs in kitchens at restaurants where they're paid very little. So it's all kinds of jobs that you're talking about.
Yes. Actually, right now, I am fighting very hard to help our restaurants remain afloat. You know, because of Amazon and a lot of online shopping in general, it's getting increasingly tough for small businesses to remain afloat on our avenues, on our main streets, if you will. And so protecting our restaurants, protecting our nail salons, the barber shop, all of these things really contribute to our public safety, in fact. But for restaurants specifically, we've seen very little economic relief for them. I was able to pass temporary liquor licenses to help new restaurants start generating revenue faster. Right now, we are trying to get more colleagues on board with the idea of making to-go drinks permanent, which is something that we experimented with during the pandemic, and it actually worked out very well and provided restaurants with a much needed revenue. So that's something that I'm working on, also putting pressure on our congressional delegation to fight as hard as they can at the federal level for the Restaurant Revitalization Fund. That needs a lot more money in it. And it's interesting because, yes, my district is known for having fantastic food, and we do. But also, many of my neighbors, in fact, the biggest cohort of restaurant workers, of hospitality workers in New York City, reside in my district. So even if they're not working in a restaurant locally, we need Manhattan, Brooklyn, and the Bronx and Staten Island to be able to hold their own as well. And this is why, you know, supporting our restaurants right now is so, so important. And for all the listeners out there, please do get out there, take date night outside, give our restaurants your dollars. And if you're ordering in, don't forget to give a generous tip to your delivery worker.
It's clear you're a woman on a mission. I like people on a mission, Jessica.
Thank you, Ed.
Just to circle back very briefly to your neighborhood, I read about a place called Prontito where you can get cholado. Why don't you tell people what cholado is, because you are a Colombian American. So talk to us about cholado.
Sure. So cholado is a fruit salad on ice. That's the easiest way to explain it. That comes from El Valle del Cauca, which is a part of the coffee growing region in Colombia, closer to the Pacific Ocean. And it is fresh fruit and fresh fruit pulp, all diced up, put on ice in a cup with condensed milk all over it. And sometimes people add some fruit juice, some people spike it a little bit, and that's it. And you eat it with a spoon and a straw. And Prontito makes a great cholado. There's also some great cholados along Northern Boulevard in Jackson Heights. This has become an increasingly popular item to consume in the warmer weather here in New York. And I have to say, you know, it being from my dad's hometown, it makes me very proud. And it's pretty healthy, except for maybe the condensed milk, which could have a lot of sugar. But it's good. I recommend it.
So we're all going to have to find the cholados in whatever neighborhood that serves them, right? Because there are, obviously in your neighborhood, in your district, there's a lot of cholado. But I've noticed that they're even starting to serve cholados outside Queens.
The only cholado I've ever had outside of Queens is in Cali, in Jamundi, in Colombia. So that would be interesting. That's fantastic. I mean, the Colombian community has definitely expanded in New York City. The biggest group is in Queens, in my district. But, I mean, we have Colombian elected officials from Brooklyn now, right? We have a state senator and a councilwoman. So it's exciting.
So, Jessica, we're going to let you go because I think you have much more important things to do than to talk to me. But keep making good trouble.
I promise I will. There's lots of good trouble to make, and we have to pull ahead together. We have to get the city out of the economic catastrophe that the pandemic put on us, but we need to do it the right way, centering working people and making sure that we're actually fixing the safety nets that had even failed us before the pandemic. We can end income inequality together. We created poverty. We can end poverty together.
I think that's a great way to end. Thank you, Jessica, for taking the time to talk to us, and we'll see you soon. When we last spoke to Jessica Ramos, I asked her how and why a New York City-based politician and activist became interested in farm labor issues.
So two things. One is I am the granddaughter of farmers. My mom's parents, and to this day, my mom now owns the farm where my family has been growing and harvesting coffee for hundreds of years. We've been coffee farmers in my family for a very long time. Most of my mom's family is in the coffee growing or selling or distributing business. We're from the coffee growing region in Colombia to this day. And like I mentioned, my mom now owns the farm that used to be my grandparents. I've had great respect for the stewards of our earth. Since I can ever remember, my parents would, of course, get rid of me and my sisters at least for a few weeks during the summer vacation, put us on a plane, ship us to Colombia to spend time with my grandparents and my cousins. And so I did spend time tilling land and understanding what a great respect we must have for Mother Nature and what the process for many of these crops were. Though my love for farming started there, my love for workers, of course, started when I worked in the labor movement here in New York. And when I was at Local 371, which represents the social workers of New York City, I became a member of the New York City chapter of LACLA, which is the Labor Council for Latin American Advancement. It's a national organization that centers its work on the fight for rights and dignity at the workplace for Latino workers in the United States. We have 100,000 farm workers in New York State, 90% of which are actually New Yorkers who live here year round. It's actually only 10% of workers who come from Mexico mainly, but also from Jamaica and Haiti to plant, to harvest, to package. And being a LACLA member, I got to meet a lot of farm workers and hear some terrible stories about how they would be forced to work for little to no money, simply for housing. Housing would be in very bad shape. They weren't getting paid overtime. They didn't have the right to a day off. And this is what a lot of people don't realize. Farm workers were carved out of labor law here in New York State way back when, because all farm workers back in the day were Black sharecroppers who came from the South. And this has long been the last vestige of Jim Crow era laws in New York.
Wow.
So having all of this information, I mean, the minute that I stepped in the New York State Senate, I declared that I would be the last state senator to carry the Farm Worker Fair Labor Practices Act. And all the farm workers, of course, looked at me like I'm a crazy woman because, I mean, by then, I think I was about the 10th state senator to carry this bill that had been languishing in the state Senate for 30 years. But I kept my word. And I knew that an instant criticism was going to be why a city girl would care so much about farm workers. What does she know about running a farm? And I wasn't going to necessarily do it in a way that created animosity. Knowing what farmers go through, especially small farmers, I wanted to do this in a way that it was an asset to everybody. And so unbeknownst to me, none of my predecessors who carried the bill had ever brought together the two sides, the farmers, largely represented by the Farm Bureau, the vegetable growers and other organizations, and the workers themselves. So we lumped everybody in a room, right? This was pre-COVID. I locked everybody in my conference room for hours and we started to hash it out. It took a few sessions. It took me traveling a lot of the North Country, a lot of the Western tier in New York State. And I held three hearings, two upstate and one out in Suffolk County, where we also have lots of farms. I wanted to, of course, make sure I was doing my due diligence. And no, not all farmers are bad employers. In fact, most farmers are good employers. But there's no reason why we shouldn't codify the basic rights of any worker, especially those that are kind of a remainder from our dark and racist past. We don't want to perpetuate any of this racism in any way, shape, or form. So today, it's the law. Farm workers have the right to a day off. Farm workers have the right to overtime pay. Farm workers have the right to disability benefits and unemployment insurance. And more importantly, farm workers have the right to organize to a union so that they can collectively bargain. And it's one of the proudest things I've done.
It's an amazing thing. And I can't imagine there were a lot of tense moments, because I'm sure the reason people never brought those two sides together was they thought that a fistfight would break out or something equivalent. How did you bridge that gap?
Well, there were definitely many tense moments during the negotiations of the bill. But, you know, we laid very clear guidelines at the beginning of the conversation that everybody adhered to about respecting each other's point of view, about utilizing facts, and about committing to an openness to understanding the other side. And also understanding that, yes, of course, while we support more and better rights and better pay for farm workers, that means that we don't want the farms to go bankrupt. We need the farms to be able to function. I mean, I think that many times people don't realize that in a lot of these, you know, labor conversations, we want the industry to flourish because that not only helps the farmers, it helps the farm workers as well. But in New York, there's a lot of factors. It's the high cost of living in New York, for example, you know, hurts a lot of the competition that many of our crops have with the surrounding states and Canada. So, for example, here in New York, I mentioned dairy farms, not as big of an industry as it used to be here in New York, but still sizable. Here in New York, we also grow a lot of onions. We grow a lot of cabbage. We, of course, grow a lot of and export a lot of apples and many other things. But it's hard for a lot of these farms to compete with the produce that is grown in New Jersey or in Vermont or even Canada. And then there's the inexplicable, which is the dumping of Chinese apples in New York State. So we famously have the Mott's plant here in New York State, right upstate. And you would think that with all of the apples that we produce, that all of that Mott's apple cider and apple juice would come from New York apples. And it does not. If you check the label, it says from concentrate from China. Why? Why? It is so frustrating. But these are the things that we need to change. I believe this is what I'm in office to do. So little by little, we're going to hopefully be able to chip away at a system that has hurt our planet, has hurt workers, and has hurt our tummies.
You have an interesting combination of characteristics, because the first thing that comes out of anyone's mouth is there's no bullshit with Jessica. And then the second thing that comes out of their mouth is she doesn't piss us off. That's a magic trick.
It's not. I'm just being myself, I swear. I think that it's very possible to disagree just about on everything with someone and still acknowledge their humanity and their dignity. And very oftentimes, and I'm actually very critical of many progressives and many members of the left of this, we love to talk about loving everybody. We love to talk about solidarity. We love to exemplify all of that with those we agree with, but we actually do have to find compassion and empathy with those that we disagree with. And we want those folks to have the space to be able to evolve and grow and win them over with that kindness and realize that that symbiotic, that horizontal solidarity is very different from the charity that capitalism teaches us is the way. So yes, a lot of people who disagree with me on the merits respect me as a person because I respect them as a person. And I still hear them out and I will tell them exactly why it is that I disagree with them and on what points. And if I have evidence, I'll use that too. And hopefully I'll win you over and you'll come over to my side.
I read that one of the farmers that you did battle with about the bill sent many truckloads of produce to your district.
Yes. So here's the full story. I passed the Farm Worker Fair Labor Practices Bill in 2019. There at the time was a Republican state senator, originally from Queens, but now living up north, Senator Ranzenhofer. He represents or represented a lot of the area around Elba, New York, which is very close to our border with Canada. And he was very concerned that, you know, I had taken such an interest on this farm workers bill, and he sent me a formal invitation to come up and visit. He didn't think I was going to say yes. Well, I did. I said, no problem. You just tell me when to be there. And we went upstate. We flew to Buffalo. From Buffalo, we drove over to Elba, New York. I met Maureen Torrey from Torrey Farms. I met a bunch of other farmers from the area. And they asked me to watch a lot of the workers plant onions, which is what they were doing. It was early spring. I ended up planting onions myself because I wanted to get the experience and I wanted to be able to talk to the farm workers. Of course, you know, having the advantage that I do speak Spanish. Spanish is actually my first language. And I wanted to get a real account about what was going on. You know, while they did highlight where they thought improvements should be made, they also expressed concerns over how the bill would affect the hours that they would be given to work, for example, overall. Well, Maureen Torrey and former state senator Ranzenhofer stuck me in a warehouse surrounded by 200 or 300 farm workers, where I suppose I was going to, quote unquote, be told off. I wasn't. It ended up being a very good conversation, and I was very clear and very unwavering in what I believe to be true and how I believe workers should be treated everywhere, what the standard should be. And so even though we walked away disagreeing, and you know, Maureen Torrey certainly put up a fight when we were in negotiations for the bill, our district got hard hit by COVID. We were, quote unquote, the epicenter of the epicenter. And at the peak of the pandemic, food insecurity was one of our largest concerns. And so I really didn't know what to do. And then it was one of those eureka moments where I was just like, wait a minute, I know a bunch of farmers. So my staff and I sat down and we decided to call every single farmer that testified against my bill. So I already knew that these folks disagreed with me, but I called them and I asked them, I was like, hey, do you have any surplus produce, any surplus milk, any surplus eggs? You know, the restaurants had largely closed, so they had lost a lot of customers. And there were even news reports of farmers dumping milk and dumping a lot of this produce. So I said, hey, I'll take it. I ended up calling some of the Teamsters to help transport it. But actually, Torrey Farms and a lot of the other farms ended up donating the transportation themselves. We were bringing down from upstate approximately 40,000 pounds of milk, eggs, fruits, vegetables, and even beef sometimes. And it ended up saving the lives of at least 5,000 families in our community every week.
Wow.
And it meant the world because it meant that they could save some money and actually put it towards paying rent. But that's what happened.
Wow, 40,000 pounds every week.
Yes, 40,000 pounds every week.
You once wrote that fighting for workers is my life purpose. And I would say that the pandemic has brought that fight into living rooms everywhere, and none more so than in your district. Talk a little bit about the pandemic and its effect on your life's work.
Before the pandemic, I had always felt like, you know, many people don't identify themselves as a worker, right? Whether you work for the MTA, whether you are a police officer, whether you are an attorney or a doctor, if you have to work for a living, you are a worker, and there should be expectations of what a safe workplace looks like, what your wages should be, what your opportunity for a dignified retirement should look like. And to me, what the pandemic really did was A, result in massive unemployment, which meant that more claims for unemployment insurance were being made in New York State than ever before. I mean, billions of dollars have been paid out from our state's unemployment insurance system. And starting from there, even freelancers, right? So many people started to realize, well, do I qualify for this? I don't qualify for this. Wait, but I'm an independent contractor. I'm not an employee. So all of these questions started coming up about worker classification, about what safety nets there are actually available for these workers. And I think it's really changed the dynamic in our collective thinking of who's a worker and how it is that we keep a worker safe when they're in charge of producing and making profit for the bosses. I think it also calls into question an era of underemployment that we're in. It's not called the New York hustle for nothing. You know, you have a part-time job, maybe you have a second part-time job, you cook tamales as your side hustle and sell them in the morning before you go to one of those part-time jobs. But ultimately, nobody's spending as much time with their families as they should be. And this is the biggest thing for me as a legislator. I want New Yorkers to be happy. I want everybody's right to be happy. Nobody's going to be happy if we're working to death.
You seem to be fearless. Where does the fearlessness come from?
I don't have anything to lose. We have nothing to lose but our chains. I mean, seriously, I'm not someone who, you know, necessarily has all of my eggs in one basket. I might, you know, I very likely won't be an elected official for my entire life. I am very fulfilled by my work, but I am not scared of being challenged. And I don't think anybody should be. I think if anything, our collective goal should be to create a more perfect union like our founding fathers intended. I also feel like a lot of these issues get swept under the rug and people are scared to have conversations about a lot of these things. People are scared of feeling uncomfortable. People are scared of having taboo conversations, and there's no reason to. I enjoy making people uncomfortable for the greater good. I'm not trying to make anybody feel bad, but I might make you confront a few things that need to be addressed head on.
But that's putting it mildly. I sort of been theorizing that it came in part from your parents, who were undocumented immigrants fighting the good fight, right? From when you were a toddler.
This is true. My mom flew from Colombia to Mexico and crossed the Mexican border at Ciudad Juarez at the age of 24. It took her 3 days. Let me tell you something about Jessica Ramos at the age of 24. I in no way, shape, or form think that I would have had the courage to pick up everything, say goodbye to my life and to all the privileges that I have in it, to then just cross a border, engage in this really dangerous activity where I could lose my life, all with the purpose of giving my family a better opportunity. My mom is my hero. Again, I don't think I would have ever been able to do that. But yes, I mean, her fearlessness, my dad's fearlessness in stepping up to politicians here in Queens back in the 90s, you know, Jackson Heights was dubbed by the Daily News the cocaine capital of the world. And being Colombian American, we grew up being stereotyped and mistreated and put down, judged by the worst among us, but also realizing that the war on drugs meant that a lot of our people, a lot of our working class peers didn't have a choice. And so, yes, all of these things, I mean, I just feel we've been through so many traumatic moments, right? Our generational trauma is so great that what's the worst that can happen?
You have made food activism and food politics local. How do we go about making these issues national? Because they are national and even international in scope, right? So we need like 1,000 more of you, like spread all over the country, man.
I don't think cloning is very ethical, personally, but I agree. You know, I think we have to be very vigilant when all of these talks of free trade agreements happen at the federal level, right? These, going back to the dumping of Chinese apples in New York, even though it's one of our main crops, right? These are all things that we as internationalists, as people from New York that are surrounded, right? The politics in every single country very much affects what happens in New York and certainly what we eat in New York. And so I would think that we all have to take a greater role in understanding what the food chain is and what we would like it to be, because everybody around the world deserves to eat healthier.
The classic example of a food activist was Cesar Chavez, but are there ongoing movements in states with lots of agricultural activity that I just don't know about?
Well, the agriculture industry here in New York is our fifth largest industry, of course, finance being the number one. But if we don't protect our farmers, we don't eat. I don't know how to put it more bluntly. farmers are some of the most important people in our lives, we need to keep Monsanto out of New York as we've been able to thus far. And we want to keep our farms small. We want to utilize also technology in order to improve how we're doing the work, how we are, for example, preserving milk. Right now, one of my big fights that's agriculture related is here in New York, we don't have a plant. We don't have the technology available in order to preserve freeze-dried milk, which other places largely do. So think packaging like for the Parmalat milk. We can't do that here in New York. Our dairy farmers don't have that ability. And to me, that would actually be a very smart investment for New York State to make in order for us to circumvent a lot of the refrigeration issues that we have within our school systems, right? A large milk consumer. Same thing with, unfortunately, our prison industrial complex. And that's another thing. I mean, there's so many frontiers here on the fight for food justice. I mean, I haven't even started my work on prison food yet. That's still to come. It's something that I'm fleshing out. But I don't believe that we can rehabilitate any human being unless we're actually feeding their body, their mind, and their soul in an appropriate way. Of course, people fight in jails and there's violence in jails. They're hungry and they're eating crap. You know, there's a lot to do in order to fix our broken food system.
I didn't know that there was no place to make shelf-stable milk in New York State. Are there plants in other states?
Yes, there are plants in other states. I believe New Jersey has a plant, which is, again, one of our main competitors. And so New York has sorely been lacking in agricultural investments in order to improve our industry and remain competitive with the states surrounding us, for sure.
Time to check in with J. Kenji Lopez-Alt, the author of The Food Lab and Every Night is Pizza Night. Kenji, my guest on this episode is State Senator Jessica Ramos, who happens to be Colombian American.
Just like my wife.
Yes, yeah. Just like your wife. And I know you and your family took a months-long vacation in Colombia a couple of years ago, exploring Colombian food ways, among other things, right?
My wife, Audrey, grew up in Colombia. And then ever since Audrey and I have been together, so for the past 12 years now, we've been traveling to Colombia at least once a year, usually twice a year. And then, yeah, we spent about 3 months, which is the longest you're allowed to get a visa there. We spent 3 months driving around all over the country, actually. So I'm quite familiar with Colombian food.
You did a great-sounding Colombian soup.
Oh, yeah. This is the first Colombian dish that I learned how to cook. It's ajiaco, which is the sort of official dish of Bogota, which is where my wife is from. So, you know, Bogota is way up in the mountains. You know, Colombia is this country that has this land area-wise, it's not gigantic, bigger than any European country, but it's not gigantic, but it has this huge diversity of climates and landscapes. So there's desert, there's Caribbean coast, there's swamps, there's mountains, there's plains, there's rainforest, you know, so it's a very diverse landscape and culture and cuisine. Bogota, though, is in the Andes. It's higher than Denver. It's like at 8,000 something feet. And a lot of the dishes they eat there are sort of these very hearty soups. In fact, you know, soup is a very common dish all over Colombia, many different kinds of soups. But the typical dish from Bogota is called ajiaco, and it's a potato and chicken soup. And it uses three different types of potatoes, which are difficult to find here. The real important one is one called papa criolla, which is this little yellow potato that I've never seen anything. I mean, the closest you could probably get is a Yukon Gold, but it's not really quite the same. When you cook them, they get this like really buttery flavor, and they turn really sort of soft and creamy. And so what you do is you basically make a chicken stock and then you boil the potatoes in it until they break down. And so the soup kind of naturally thickens up into this really creamy, rich texture. The idea behind the three different potatoes is that one of them gives it this really creamy texture, while another one sort of stays intact in sort of discrete chunks, and the other one adds a different flavor to it. When I do it in the U.S., I find frozen papa criolla, which you can get at most Latin markets, especially ones that import from Ecuador and Colombia, Venezuela, areas around there. These yellow potatoes, russet potatoes, and red potatoes, and you boil them together until they kind of completely tenderize. And then it's served with chopped capers, sour cream, a specific type of Colombian sour cream, but you can use regular sour cream at home. And then ají, which is Colombian hot sauce. Ají means pepper, like chili pepper, but it's also the name of a sort of family of sauces. You know, similar to like what you'd think of as like salsa in Mexico. In Colombia, there's ají, which is these fresh hot sauces. Make like a very simple ají with like onion, cilantro, and chilies, and you kind of spoon that plus the capers and shredded chicken, avocado, like hot avocado is a thing that's very common there. So you put the avocado in the soup, and then corn. You know, they use large kernel sort of starchy corn, the kind you would make like hominy out of, which you can also find typically frozen at the same Latin markets. if not regular corn works. It's my wife's favorite dish. Yeah, it's delicious.
And this sounds like a really hearty soup. It sounds like a meal. It doesn't sound like an appetizer.
It's a meal, yeah. You know, lunch is the biggest meal of the day there. And so a typical Colombian lunch would be a few different courses. So usually you would have fresh fruit first, and then you would have your soup. And oftentimes, you know, the soup is hearty enough that that's your whole meal. But if you're doing something a little more extravagant, you would have your soup, and then you would have what's called your seco, like your dry dish. You would have rice and roast beef or something like that. And then some sort of simple cheese or sweet thing for afterwards. But usually Colombian meals, lunches are quite hearty and often feature a soup.
Thank you, my friend. We'll talk soon.
All right. Thanks, Ed.
That's it for this episode of Special Sauce. I want to thank the irrepressible New York State Senator Jessica Ramos, whose fierce advocacy for working people should be celebrated by all of us, as well as Kenji Lopez Alt, whose new best-selling book is The Wok. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another brand new episode of Special Sauce. So long, serious eaters. See you next time.
Special Sauce is produced by John Kalish and Ed Levine. Our theme music was composed by Charlie Morrow for Morrow Sound.